Good morning. This is Martha Odom, KBOO Radio. With us today, back in Portland, is Derek Jensen, who is the author of A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and the newly published from Seven Stories Press, Endgame. So before we talk politics, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Derek Jensen?
I kind of hate that question because I don't know how to answer.
Well, just let us know who the person is a little bit.
Well, see, that's the thing is, am I a writer? Because all the answers end up being so precious. You know, I'm a human being who lives on, you know, Talawa land in Northern California. And that's true, but it also sounds kind of precious. I mean, but I hate to say I'm a writer because I'm not just a writer. I'm also an activist. I'm also a human being. Anyway, so a little bit. I live in Northern California. I like that because I'm not saying I am, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Northern California. I live on Talawa land. I've pretty much devote my life to both understanding this culture's pervasive destructiveness and to, more importantly, to stopping it. And I guess I'm comfortable with that, with saying that's who I am, is I'm somebody who desperately wants to stop this culture from killing the planet.
I'd love to spend one whole interview talking about your experiences teaching creative writing at Pelican Bay Prison. That I've been around that place a little bit, and it's pretty interesting stuff, but we'll save that for another time.
That'd be great.
Endgame. It's probably the most aerobic book I've ever read. I've got lots of exercise walking around trying to digest all the information in it. One of the major premises is civilization is bad. All our conditioning, like from day one, teaches that civilization is right. Everything from our national identity down to how we deal with bodily functions. So what's the deal? What's the problem with civilization?
Well, there's a bunch of them, not the least of which is that it's killing the planet. And it's really extraordinary to believe that you can destroy a planet and live on it too. And this, you know, I mentioned before that I live on Talawa land, and the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe what science tells us, and if you believe what the Talawa tell us, then they lived here since the beginning of time. And this culture has been here for 170 years, and it's hammering the area. And, you know, whatever measure we want to take, you know, the passenger pigeons are gone, the salmon are going, there's 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's, you know, the oceans are essentially murdered, global warming, you know, there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk, you know, whatever. The USGS, not, you know, flaming environmentalists, but the USGS says that there's carcinogens in every stream in the United States, and which shouldn't surprise us once again, since there's carcinogens in every mother's breast milk. And it's absolutely insane to think that you can destroy a planet and live on it. So there's, on that level, it's bad. On another level, it destroys every indigenous culture it encounters. I mean, try living as a hunter-gatherer in a functioning community on Manhattan Island at this point. You know, it systematically destroys alternatives. It systematically destroys indigenous peoples. There have been cultures that have existed with very low rape. There have existed cultures where child abuse is pretty much non-existent. You know, it's like, what measure do you want to choose? And we can talk about that. But of course, we have to perceive ourselves as the best way to be, because for a couple reasons. One is that no one can commit any mass atrocity without first convincing themselves and others that what they're doing is not, in fact, harmful, but instead good. I mean, from his own perspective, Hitler wasn't committing genocide. He was purifying the Aryan race. And the whites who stole the land from the Indians were not committing genocide. They were fulfilling their manifest destiny. And nowadays, you know, this is not killing the planet. It's developing natural resources. And, I mean, this is true on a personal level, too. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have never in my life been a jerk, you know. Every time I've ever been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized beforehand. And then afterwards, of course, I can go, oh, my gosh, I was a real jerk. But for the most part, the capacity to rationalize is pretty extraordinary. And that's part of what we have to convince ourselves in order to continue with this wretched system. And then which once again, I mean, it's not just salmon out there or, you know, passenger pigeons out there. And it's not, I mean, there's a couple things. One of them is that I ask people at my talk, how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 90% or 80% say that they have had someone they love die of cancer. And of course, cancer is a disease of civilization, due in part to the toxification of the total environment.
And in many ways, reading through your book, the real big C is not cancer, which is only a symptom, but civilization that's the cause.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's been systematically. I mean, we say that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. And I'm going to lay out a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. When people think of the hillsides and plains of Iraq, you know, is the first thing that they think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how it was prior to civilization beginning. The first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh cutting the forest to make cities. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak forest. And the Near East, you know, there's the cedars of Lebanon, you know, they still have one on their flag. And that was all heavily forested. And Greece was heavily forested. Aristotle, I think it was complaining that deforestation was damaging water quality. And I'm sure that those in power said, yeah, we need to study this for a couple of years to make sure there's a real connection. They probably formed a committee or something. And North Africa was heavily forested. And, you know, forests precede this culture and deserts dog its heels. It's just this culture has been destroying its land base, and it's been destroying all adjoining cultures as it metastasizes across the globe. And once again, it's not just out there. You know, it's also, I ask people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what does that mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things that they'd rather not do?
You state in the book that cities are an essential piece of civilization as destruction, and you point out that for a city to exist, you have to import resources, that a city can't grow its own food, doesn't have resources for building materials, the whole gamut of stuff that you need to survive in a city, you got to get from someplace else. So where do you go for it?
Well, see, that's one of the deals, too, is I've been bashing civilization for, gosh, 10 or 15 years now. And when I did this book, I realized, you know, I've been bashing it for a long time. I probably better define it. And the way I define it is civilization is a way of life that's based on, that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. So the Talua, whom I've mentioned a few times, were not civilized. They didn't have cities. They didn't require the importation of resources. They lived with what the land gave willingly. And a couple of things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of life can never, ever be sustainable, because as soon as you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area, as we see. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if the people next watershed over aren't going to trade you for it, you'll take it. And so what this means is we can all become absolutely enlightened, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to oil? How else are they going to steal oil from people all over the world, which they need to maintain their economic system? And that goes back to the whole sustainability thing, that you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Eventually, you know, you will use it up. So if you have a way of life that's based on, oh gosh, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil, you know, eventually the you're going to run out, and it would be really wise to think about what you're going to do then. And so, you know, it's not sustainable, and it destroys the land bases, and we need to face that fact, and we need to do something about it. So even if it were, even if civilization were this wonderful, amazing, beautiful thing, then we would still need to face the fact that you can't destroy a planet and live on it. And I have a new slogan these days, which is, protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. and the reason is because it doesn't matter, you know, I mean, I love baseball, you know, except the designated hitter rule. I love baseball, and I love Beethoven and Mozart and blues, and I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I like, but that doesn't alter the fact that, you know, you can't, if you're destroying the planet, if you're destroying your land base, nothing else matters. That's the most important thing. The only measure by which we'll be judged by the people who come after is the health of the land base.
In case there are people who come after.
Exactly.
We are talking with Derek Jensen, author of Endgame. Derek, one of the points you made in the book that helped me, it gave name and form to something that's been floating around my head and talked about it and agonized over it, is how much we're in denial and that we're actually participating in our own doom. And you talked about, you said we're all insane, and referred to it as complex PTSD. The other part is you made very, very strong parallels between domestic violence and societal violence, and we're starting to sort of understand how we deal with domestic violence, that it's a whole syndrome and has stages and stuff. Could you talk a little bit about this? Because I am continually stunned by people who don't want to know. If they know, they don't want to be reminded, they don't want to do anything about it, well, let's just go shopping or drink beer and watch the ball game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's several parts to this. One of them is, in the 1960s, this guy, Lester Laborsky, did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and he would track where they would look. And what he found, he would show them photographs, and what he found was that if the photograph contained something that they found morally objectionable or that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once track to it, never once, which means they would see it out of the corner of their eyes, and they would know where not to look. And, you know, this happens all the time. That it's like, I had this friend who said she wished she could just shake George Bush and say to him, you could do so much to stop global warming and blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, I can tell you exactly what he would say, which is, I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, a lot of it is the denial is so deep that you literally can't see it. And we can't just, I mean, don't even need to look at George Bush. There's a great example, several years ago, this woman got arrested. She was the wife of a DEA agent in Colombia, the head DEA guy, I think. And she got arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And she said later that she was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and not see it. And if we're presuming that they weren't telling a story to keep him out of prison, I mean, that shows the level of denial. And I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, I know that whenever I've been in a really, really bad relationship, you know, there are so many things I can't see. And, you know, if any of my friends attempt to point them out to me, it's like, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then once the thing's over, it's like, oh, my God, how do they not see that?
And the statistic says that a battered woman returns an average of 7 times to her batterer before she gets it together to leave.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that sort of leads to the next thing, there's two more things about this. One of them is that R.D. Lang came up with the 3 rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also 3 rules of a dysfunctional culture. This is why we don't talk about it. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this means within the context, I mean, as you know, that my own father is extremely violent, and when I was a child, we could talk about anything we wanted in the entire world except for my father's violence, which wasn't happening. And then, of course, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about my father's violence Because if we would have been talking about the fact that we couldn't talk about it, then there would have been some violence happening for us not to be talking about. But of course, we had to pretend that the violence wasn't happening. We had to not see it. It had to disappear. And it's the same on the larger scale, where we can talk, you know, for years about you know, all sorts of trivia, Brad and Angelina and Jennifer Aniston and all this stuff, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We have to just sort of soldier on. And then this brings us to the complex PTSD thing, that most of us are aware of what post-traumatic stress disorder is. The normal PTSD is like if a woman is if something traumatic happens to you, things that remind you of that trauma can bring it back to you. So if a woman was raped in a certain make and model of car, if she sees that type of car, it can trigger her. Or there were beatings when I was a child. There were beatings associated with water skiing. And so, like when I was a teenager, if some friend would ask me to go water skiing, I would freak out. And instead of just saying, no thanks, I'm not really interested, I would totally flip. And that's because it would trigger that in me. It would take me back there, except I was entirely unaware. I was unconscious of that process. I just knew that I was terrified as soon as somebody mentioned water skiing. And that sort of PTSD can happen, with various specific incidents. But Judith Herman, who wrote this great book called Trauma and Recovery, said, what happens if someone is not traumatized once or twice, but instead is actually held in captivity for years? And that can be in prison, it can be in domestic violence, it can be through school. And what happens if you're systematically traumatized? And what she found is that then, instead of it simply being one or two triggers, that you can come to believe that all relationships are based on hierarchy, that mutual relationships aren't really possible. Relationships are based on dominance and submission. And you can come to believe that everything is scary, and so you can attempt to control everything. And so because the things that, I mean, if something's very scary, of course you've got to control it, because it could attack you at any moment. So if you're traumatized in that way, you can become incredibly closed off emotionally and incredibly controlling. And that, of course, is what we see on this large scale. My indigenous friends have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally view listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really works. And the way Thomas Berry puts this is that the world is not made of objects to be exploited, but instead subjects with whom we should enter into relationship. And so we've all been so terrified and traumatized by this culture that we can't even conceptualize anymore the notion of entering into a conversation with a tree, of listening to what a river might have to say. Oh, rivers and trees don't speak. And that's really, really central to everything, because there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this tree right here, I see this tree right here, I'll treat it differently still. The same is true, of course, for fish. You know, if when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, that's one thing, blah, blah, blah. And the same is true, of course, for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And so our whole culture has traumatized us to the point where we're so terrified to actually see these others as individuals with whom we can and should enter into relationship. And one of the ways this plays out on the larger scale, with the whole culture being traumatized like this, is the best way to control something is if it is uniform, or as if it's dead. And that's one reason why this culture has killed the forest, is because it perceives them as resources to be exploited, and B, because it needs to manage them, it needs to control them, as opposed to simply letting them be. I mean, how strange a notion is that, to actually let a river be? No, you have to put in this concrete straitjacket. You know, there's 2 million dams in this country. There's 60,000 dams over 6 feet tall, and 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6 feet tall.
So
that's
Derek,
a lot. Sorry, go ahead.
Carrying the abuser metaphor, there is, down towards the end stage of being an abuser, the idea that if I can't have her, nobody else can, and mm-hmm. translating that to societal violence, if I can't rule the planet, nobody else will either.
Yeah.
And you write that we are in the thrashing endgame of civilization. So talk about you coping with fear, legitimate grief, sometimes overwhelming rage, despair, and staying functional.
Huh. Well, yeah, that's a really, really important question. And I think the way that I talk about that is that, and I usually say this at my talks too, this is a pretty important story. A few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who was working on toxic issues, pesticide issues here in Northern California. And called up and said, you know, this work is so hard. I'm just falling apart. It's breaking my heart, and it's killing me. And I said, yeah, I know it'll do that. And then she said, you know, this culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. And she said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? It just wants to destroy things. I said, yeah, it does. And she said that unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it stops. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said the best thing I could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing I could possibly say is because 12 or 13 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just crying all the time. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, just take a break, Derek. You know, the problems will be here when you come back. I knew I needed to not take a break. I mean, I needed to just keep pushing, because if you're not going to cry about the death of this family, what are you going to cry about? You know, what do tears mean? And one day I was talking to this American Indian friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, and I was just crying, and I said, you know, this work is so hard. It's just, it's breaking my heart. It's killing me. And she said, yeah, it'll do that. And then I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stops. And then I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And then she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain, and that I can feel all those things that wouldn't kill me. And you know, that's one of the things, is there's this understanding or this idea that if you recognize, if you if you internalize how bad things are, if you really fully face that, then you have to be miserable all the time. But that's just not true. I mean, I'm full of rage, and I'm full of sorrow, and I'm full of joy, and I'm full of love, and I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really, really screwed, and that life is really, really good. Life is so wonderful, and the trees are so beautiful, and I've got wonderful friends, and I'm really, really happy, and we're really screwed. And you know, we're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time, and that's part of it, is that to recognize that I can feel those things, and it's not even so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts, it is my resistance to it. They're just feelings.
And I have grown very fond of saying that my activism is my antidote to despair, that the minute I quit being active, it's going to swell up and absolutely overwhelming.
Yep.
So exactly. There's a new piece of that, becoming an enemy of the state. Certainly reading your book, you're advocating things that, you know, no habeas corpus, you could get extremely renditioned.
I don't think they're going to do that right now because they're winning. And as soon as they stop winning, I'm dead.
Okay. So talk about symbolic resistance versus action. The difference, you know, we've marched and, you know, done nice safe civil disobedience, step over the line stuff. And I am coming more and more to think of that as just a safety valve to burn off some steam so we can keep on living with the status quo. And I'm starting to really worry about that.
I think that I mean, I got no problem, by the way. I need to say this closely. I got no problem with doing marches and holding signs and everything. I think one of the things that we often forget is that there is a difference between symbolic and non-symbolic actions. And I'm not going to diss symbolic or non-symbolic actions, just we need to recognize the difference. And a symbolic action would be something that's primarily meant to convey a message. Writing a book would be a symbolic action. Holding a sign is a symbolic action. And to jump to a different culture here, not a different culture, but a different time and different government, there were many plots against Hitler. And the German resistance to Hitler recognized that Hitler needed to die. And that's not a symbolic act. He physically needed to die in order for Nazism to be stopped. And I'm not saying, by the way, that the only non-symbolic actions are murder. I'm in no way saying that. You could have some people could liberate some cats from a vivisection lab, and that could have symbolism in terms of, you know, rallying people, and it also liberates those particular cats who are not symbolic. They are cats whose lives are no longer full of torment. And the thing, it's like people, you know, I talk a lot about dam removal and how there's, you know, okay, that's a really important thing, that okay, what do salmon need to survive? Salmon need for basically six things to happen in order for them to survive. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. I'm not saying logging and fishing. I'm saying industrial logging and industrial fishing. I'm not saying subsistence. Very clear on that. Anyway, they need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And then for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. And those are all straightforward technical tasks. If they were space aliens who had come down and they were putting in all these dams, if they were putting, you know, doing all this stuff, we would know what to do. If it was Islamo-fascists who had invaded the United States and who were systematically killing the salmon, we would know what to do. But because it's, because we don't recognize that the government right now, the government is a government of occupation. Because we don't recognize that, we, you know, hold our placards and everything. And once again, I'm not saying anything wrong with holding placards, but at some point, holding a sign or writing a book doesn't do anything for salmon by itself. At some point, dams need to come down. At some point, industrial logging needs to stop because of the sedimentation, etc. And at some point, things need to change. Physical things in the real physical world. And the question is, how do we achieve those? And once again, you can do many things through symbolic action. And there are things you can't do through symbolic action. And I think the thing we really need to ask ourselves, a really, really important thing, is to ask, what do you want? And most of us don't have any idea what we want. Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts? Do we want to, you know, do we want for the Cardinals to win the World Series? You know, what do we want? And I'm really, really clear on what I want. And what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and that has less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. I want to live in a world that has great apes. I want to live in a world that has marlins and sharks. I want to live in a world that has angel sharks who are critically endangered. I want to live in a world with prairie dogs. I want to live in a world with polar bears. And I'll do what it takes to get there. And the question becomes, what do we need to do? And once again, many of those actions can be symbolic, and many of them can be non-symbolic. But I think we need to think really hard. First off, what do we want? And second, how are we going to go about getting it? And we have to recognize that there is nothing, nothing, nothing more important than our land base. Because once again, without a land base, you don't have anything.
So we're talking with author Derek Jensen. And Derek, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the question of violence. Activists debate, squabble, fight over what is peaceable, appropriate. I think you wrote the most critical issue of our time is what we should be doing to bring it down.
Right. And part of the reason that, okay, there's the book has many, many premises, and that I state explicitly. And one of the most important premises, I think, is that this culture is based on a rigidly defined, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is fully rationalized or often invisible. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And it's usually unthinkable, though, but when it does happen, it's met with those. And there's bazillions of examples of that. I mean, you know, within an abusive... I mean, my father could beat anybody he wanted with impunity, but the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy, essentially. He'd sent violence up the hierarchy. And, you know, cops are allowed to commit violence with impunity, pretty much. And there's a great example. This is a perfect example. This guy in Oklahoma beat his wife to death, got 7 years. And as he was going through the trial process, he spat on a cop. And for that, he was sentenced to life in prison because he sent violence up the hierarchy. And so I think one of the things we need to do is to, that's one of the things first, is we really need to think about the whole, we need to come up with some definitions of violence. I mean, I've had pacifists say to me that they're against all violence. It's like, okay, does that mean you never defecate? Because every time you defecate, of course, you're killing, you know, bazillions of bacteria. Does that mean you never eat? I mean, there is violence all the time. And the question becomes, what forms of violence are we against? And I'm not saying that all violence is good, but my point is, you can't say all violence is bad, because then what you're saying is no one ever, ever is going to eat. And so first off, we should try to think clearly about this and start to define what is violence. And, I mean, people talk a lot about so-called eco-terrorists and how, you know, they're doing these acts of violence. It's like, no, they're not. I mean, they're burning down an empty building. That's not an act of violence. That's an act of sabotage. It's an act of arson, but that's not an act of violence unless you are an animist who believes that the building is alive. And we can have that whole other discussion. But anyway, the point is, let's start thinking clearly about violence and thinking about when violence may or may not be appropriate. And it's like one of the reasons I wrote that whole section on pacifism in there is because when I've done talks where I talk about violence at all, the response by the audience was really, really predictable. And that's a lot of sort of mainstream activists and peace and social justice activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would sort of say the names Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama again and again to just keep all sorts of evil thoughts at bay. And then different groups would have entirely different responses, like prisoners or family farmers or survivors of domestic violence or American Indians, many of them, or a lot of poor people of color. A lot of them would look at me like, tell us something we don't know. And I realized that the difference was that for these latter groups, violence is not some abstract or spiritual question to be puzzled through. It's simply a part of life that you deal with. That doesn't mean you do it yourself, and it doesn't mean you don't do it. It means it's just part of life. And the thing that started to really bother me was that a lot of the lines that are thrown out by pacifists, dogmatic pacifists especially, they don't make any sense. Like you always hear, you can't use a master's tool to dismantle the master's house. And, well, first off, the people who say that have never read the essay from which it comes, because it has nothing to do with pacifism. And second, as much as I love Audre Lorde, she never built a house, because it doesn't matter whose tools you use. It's a nonsensical metaphor. I can use anybody's tools to dismantle the master's house. And besides which, it presumes, A, that violence is one of the master's tools, and B, that it's the master's house. But I want to talk about the whole master's tools thing, that's not... Those in power tell us that they own the land. They tell us they own the water. They're trying to tell us they own the air. They're trying to tell us they own genetic materials. And they want to tell us that they own violence, too. I don't think that mother grizzly bears are going to agree with that. Or another one I get all the time, that if you really loved enough, if you just loved enough that you would never even consider any act of violence, the idea that love implies pacifism. And
that's also a domestic violence victim's response
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said that's also a response from a domestic violence victim. If I just loved enough.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. But that's just nonsense. Because, I mean, I grew up in the country, and in my life, I've been attacked by mother horses, cows, geese, chickens, dogs, cats, hummingbirds, spiders, mice, hawks, eagles, who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse is going to take on somebody 6,000 times her size, you know, I mean, once again, I don't think mother grizzly bears are going to agree that love implies pacifism. And there's one more of these I want to talk about real quick about the whole pacifism thing that it gets two more real fast. One of them is the notion that if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. And that's just nonsense. I mean, does that mean that the woman who fights back against a rapist runs the risk of becoming a rapist? Does that mean that Tecumseh ran the risk of becoming like the people who were stealing their land? Does that mean that a tiger who fights back against a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? And then one other is they say violence never accomplishes anything. And that's just really obscene, because what that implies is all the Africans who came over on the slave ships did so voluntarily. And it implies that the American Indians gave their land up voluntarily, that it wasn't taken from them by violence. And it implies that women, that half the population of the planet, isn't terrified because of men's violence against women. There's a great line by Robin Morgan where she talks about anywhere in the world, any woman walking alone late at night, if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. And she calls that the democracy of fear. And that's because of men's violence against women. Violence is incredibly effective. That's why those in power use it. And that doesn't mean, once again, I'll be really, really clear, that doesn't mean that we should use, I in no way, people say, do you advocate violence, Derek? And I say, no. I advocate putting all of our options on the table. I don't advocate violence any more than I advocate nonviolence. I advocate looking at our options and deciding reasonably, rationally, consciously what we want to do, not listening to Gandhi as a guide, not listening to me as a guide, not listening to, not taking an outside moral system, but instead really determining for ourselves what is right.
Gandhi only had to overthrow the British Empire. We have to save the planet.
Well, and he also had a bunch of, we in the West don't like to talk about this, but there were also armed revolutions going on at the same time.
Yeah. This has been Derek Jensen. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank
Cabin
you.
Loves talking to you. You're in Portland. You're talking Friday night. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, well, I would if I knew very much about it. It's at Disjuncta, I think it is.
Disjecta?
Disjecta.
Yeah, it's 2:30.
Something, East or West Burnside, I think.
Yeah, East Burnside, right under the east end of the Burnside Bridge, and a creative writing workshop on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm doing two, I'm pretty sure. One in the afternoon, one in the morning. And information about both those is at my website under the appearances section. So it's derekjensen.org, and then click on appearances because I don't have the details memorized. And it should be really fun. And are you going to make it?
I expect to see you on Friday night. I have another commitment on Saturday, some symbolic activism.
Mm-hmm. Which is very important.
And we're having fun. It's Code Pink.
Oh, can I say one thing about that?
You bet.
You know, it's like protests. I don't understand why more people don't do them, because even if they don't really accomplish much, they're so much fun.
That's true.
It's just a gas, you know, to wander around and, you know, protest the circus or protest whatever it is you're going to protest.
And we have fun costumes, too. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight. And thank you so much. This is Martha Odom with Derek Jensen on KBOO, your community radio station. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you so much. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm turning stuff off.
Hey, well, thanks for that.
That was kind of good. We could have talked for a long time. It'd been much more fun at the Chinese buffet, but...
yeah. Well, let's do it again sometime.
Okay.
And by all means, introduce yourself Friday.